This is Michael Scharf. The date is April 3rd, 2013. I'm speaking with Gord Evans. We're at the Woodrow Wilson School at Princeton University. Mr. Evans, thanks so much for your time this morning.
Thank you, Michael.
For our listeners, would you be able to tell us briefly how you became involved in supporting and studying cabinet office effectiveness?
Sure. Well, I guess it all begins when I worked in the government of Ontario in Canada. I worked in the cabinet office there for 8 years. I was something, I always have an obscure title, something called the Deputy Clerk of the Executive Council, which basically meant that I was the person that sat in on the cabinet meetings and the committee meetings and took the minutes. And also, I was the person that was in charge of coordinating government planning and the overall sort of policy, the machinery of government stuff. So having done that for 8 years, I thought it would be time for a good career switch, and I thought it would be interesting to go out and work internationally and maybe go work with cabinet offices around the world and see how that would work. I found, however, when I first left, that actually there wasn't a lot of work in this area, and it was largely unknown, like this obscure thing called the Center of Government and Cabinet Office, which is so important to anyone that works in government, somehow hadn't permeated the donor community. Fortunately for my career, the World Bank was just coming to the same conclusion that things like prime ministers and cabinets and cabinet offices should be something that was looked at. So I was able to sort of link on with them and help them develop an approach to it. So that was in 98, so here we are 15 years later, and I've been working in, I guess, about 25 or 30 countries since then.
So on the topic of cabinet office effectiveness, I wonder, what are the most common reasons that a head of state would want to improve the effectiveness of their cabinet office?
Well, it affects them personally. I mean, their lives, if it's not working, their lives become a living hell. I mean, to a prime minister, time is a finite resource, and if they're spending 6.5, or in the case of Afghanistan, 12 hours in a cabinet room hearing endless debates and meaningless presentations, it drives them crazy. Mm-hmm. So they want their time used well. They want to have it focused on decision making. They'd like to know that the things they care about, someone in government is doing it. And so they need all this machinery of government to work reasonably well for them, to help them govern. So they have a strange thing. How could you get a prime minister interested in this very abstruse kind of activities? And the answer is, well, it affects them very intensely on a personal level. Mm-hmm. So it's easy.
Thanks for that. Mm-hmm. Just building off of that, I wonder, in your view, what are the three or four main steps or changes that usually produce the biggest improvements in cabinet office performance?
Yeah. Well, like anything, the answer will be depends. And, not every prime minister is going to devote their personal time to this. It has to come from them. So, in a sense, let's start in the case where the prime minister really wants something to happen, really is having trouble with their agenda or something like that, you might attempt a more ambitious reform in that case, because the prime minister is going to be behind it and ministers will pay attention and they will do something. If, however, the prime minister is thinks basically things are okay, he's focused on other issues, maybe domestic issues or international issues, he has a lot to do. In that case, the more effective reforms are going to be more at the administrative level. So again, that's the depends. In terms of ones that are really affected, I mean, again, it depends on what's there in the country at the time. Mm-hmm. If it's a country like we've talked about earlier today, about some fragile states or states that have just coming to terms with being a new sort of quasi-democratic governments, in those cases, they may have, if things are fairly chaotic, then it's going to be the very rudimentary things that make the biggest changes. A well-managed cabinet meeting, a manual that allows ministries to prepare policy papers or draft legislation in a consistent manner, good, flowing of documents, good distribution of documents, all these sort of very rudimentary things.
And so those would be the administrative level changes that you speak of.
Yeah, and that'll be very, very important in those sorts of cases. in the case of a prime minister whose his agenda isn't getting through, it's going to be something very different. It's going to be how government planning works, how it links to the budget process in particular, how donor money is channeled through into priorities. It's how ministers, do they actually do what the prime minister is hoping the minister will do, or do they just go off and do their own thing? What are the collective accountability mechanisms? So it's a much more complex set of reforms that you will do it there. And in those cases, the things that have made the most difference are just simply making sure that the center of government that supports the prime minister fully understands and works closely with the ministries to make sure that these things are monitored and managed on an ongoing basis.
I want to ask you about the biggest implementation challenges you've seen across countries as they pertain to cabinet reforms. Maybe the way to approach that question is to actually break it down by the two subsets of reforms you just spoke of in your previous answer. So taking first to those ambitious, bigger, higher level, more challenging reforms, and then talking about the administrative reform. So for each of those, what you see as sort of the biggest challenges that come into play when attempting them?
Yeah. I mean, in the a couple levels, let's start with the lower level ones, the administrative reforms. The biggest challenge there quite often is just simply there aren't enough people in the cabinet office. I mean, cabinet office liaison officers in ministries. So if you don't have the institutional infrastructure to do it, there's only so much you can do. Because if you end up, I've seen cabinet offices as small as two people. So obviously that's right. Going to affect the scope of what you're going to be. You can still do things with two people, but it's much more limited. The higher up ones are the more complex ones where you run into more problems. And that gets things, you can become overly grandiose in your designs, and especially in very poor countries where the donor community is very, very influential, and they're talking them into doing whole of government reforms or big comprehensive public administrative reforms, it quickly becomes, the absorption capacity across government becomes almost impossible. I mean, they get inundated with it. On the one hand, the donors are telling them to set priorities. On the other hand, they're telling them to do 300 things. So there's a bit of a contradiction there. The other problem that's often overlooked is you'll get a core of reformers at the center of government, which works very well in terms of getting the reform designed and approved, but then it all falls apart at the implementation stage, which is back to your question. And that's because either the capacity isn't there in the ministries, or the knowledge isn't there, or the ministries have not, and what is more common, is usually more capacity than people imagine, is the ministries themselves have never been brought along. They're barely aware that this reform is happening. They live in their own universe there, and that in itself slows it down. And also some of these reforms, like if you get into things like anti-corruption strategies or poverty reduction strategies, they affect 10, 15 ministries. And the complexity of doing this kind of horizontal policy in, new governments, developing governments, it can be, overwhelming. So the design may just not fit with the ability of ministries to actually deliver.
So you mentioned that oftentimes ministries are just not aware to the ongoing reform. They're not brought along, to use your terminology. Are there any specific examples that, looking back on your work, that where this has been the case, or in lieu of specific examples, strategies that you've seen to be able to sort of get the word out there and make ministers and their staff aware of
yeah,
these changes?
I don't really want to name a particular country, but one example is, again, to some of this gets down to primeministerial enthusiasm or presidential enthusiasm. Often the reform, it would maybe driven by sort of a World Bank or, project or something like that. There'll be a reform team, and they'll work with themselves, and they'll come up with all these things. his new sort of approaches. But if they haven't had ministry representatives on the team, if the prime minister hasn't been sort of fronting this as something that he or she really wants to do, hasn't been telling the ministers that it's going to be part of their job that they're going to do it, if the ministries and the ministers don't sense that it actually is important to the prime minister, they'll just tune it out. They're busy people. And these projects come and go, especially in developing countries where donors are all over the place. They, you know, they come and go, and they fade into the mists of time. And they develop because, you know, sort of a defense mechanism against being inundated with all these things from the center. So unless that reform can really make its case to the ministries that it is something that is going to be there for a while and that the prime minister really supports, that's what will happen to it. And again, there's to some degree, there's often things are critiqued for, you know, they should have had a better communication strategy and all this kind of stuff. But they usually always have communication strategies. The reality is the ministries just tune it out unless there's a true conveyance from the prime minister that they're going to do that. Hmm. And they want, he's interested in it.
As you know, ISS has conducted several case studies about adoption of delivery units, and delivery units will vary across countries. Some have a broader scope of responsibility than others, for instance. I'd like to ask if you'd share your thoughts and your views about when delivery units are most likely to work and when they tend to fail or lose support.
Yeah. Well, again, you have to look, again, country context is important here. The famous delivery unit is Tony Blair's UK one. Although there's been things like it before and many things like it afterwards. But in the developing world, and in the developed countries, you have to realize that in general, monitoring of ministry performance within a center of government is more of a delegated function. I mean, in most times, you don't have a unit in the center of government that monitors ministries. Ministry of Finance does and things like that, but it's delegated. There's performance contracts with deputy ministers and, you know, sometimes with ministers. There's accountability mechanisms. There's data openly available if anyone wants to check it. There's cabinet office people that stay in close touch with the ministries. So you don't really have to have, you know, a monitoring unit there all the time. In developing countries, on the other hand, there's almost always a desire to have, or they have, a monitoring unit. Because there's a feeling that unless ministries are reminded or that there's a follow-up system, is things just won't get done. And, you know, there was this World Bank study that has been cited where they found that in one African country, the 75% of cabinet's decisions hadn't been implemented. So there's a big difference there. If you create a delivery unit in a developed country, it's because you're making a statement that for a finite period of time, not a permanent time, a finite period of time, the government wants to focus on, usually, in most cases, it's usually some priorities of the president or the prime minister. Usually they're complex ones that involve multiple ministries. And that unit is there to sort of symbolize that they really care about those things, and that ministries should also care about those things. And then they work to make sure that happens. Again, in developing countries, that unit will already be there tracking all sorts of stuff. So what it has to evolve into is, in addition to its tracking every stuff role, it also then usually takes on a special sort of priority tracking role. And again, in the poorer countries where the donors are dominating the policy landscape because, you know, they're funding it, that unit will also get enmeshed in donor liaison and working with the donors to see how the money flows. In the more middle-income countries, like we looked at the Baltics, for instance, it's different. I mean, there they can actually create delivery units that are similar to the developed country ones, where they actually focus on priorities and things like that.
How about if you're setting up a delivery unit in a parliamentary system versus a presidential system? Do the opportunities and the challenges vary between the two?
Well, you know, this gets into it. It'd be a little different, but again, within parliamentary systems, you have to probably divide it, you know, just for the sake of, into majority government parliamentary systems and coalition parliamentary systems. In a majority government system, it's reasonably easy to do in the sense that that unit will be operating clearly under the Prime Minister. Every ministry will be attuned to making sure that what the Prime Minister wants to do, that happens. In the divided coalition system where there's a strong coalition partner, it might be a little different in the sense that they will see each ministry may be under a different party. So the ones that aren't under the government parties may be more suspicious that delivery unit is just simply representing, you know, their opponent. So they'll want some kind of validation from their own party that, sure, you know, this is okay. So it just makes it a little more complicated. It's not that it can't work, but it you know, you have to recognize the additional steps and hoops that are involved. In a presidential system, a peer presidential system, I don't think it's any more difficult to set up and operate because the departments are under the president's authority. But what you would have there is they'd have to have obviously a much stronger liaison function with you know, in the States it'd be congressional, but you know, whatever sort of with the legislative functions, because the legislative system you know, they'll have much more influence than in a pure parliamentary system.
Yeah. I'm curious what strategies you've seen a head of state employ in selecting top priorities, particularly in a situation when he or she is governing by coalition and needs to satisfy the many different and what are sometimes competing interests.
Yeah. I mean, well, again, the whole issue of priorities is one of the most abstract discussions you can have in government because it can mean so many things. You know, just to give one example, when I was in one of the, sort of emerging European countries, they had some document that they'd committed to that had 638 priorities in it. And then they had their European Union document, which had 432, if I remember. So, you know, they had well over 1,000 priorities. So it becomes rather, contradiction in terms. In terms of actually narrowing it down to something more focused, they do it a lot of ways. I mean, a lot of times it will come from their campaign platform. In again, very poor countries, it will come as a result of negotiations with the donor community, the IMF, World Bank, like to some degree, because so much of the budget is provided from them. They're often expressed in different ways. In some cases, the president, the prime minister, may make an annual address. In some cases, the president, the prime minister doesn't really. They let the budget do the talking. So the budget priorities become the country's priorities. In other cases, they may work it through a cabinet process, and coming out of that, they may have, say, these four or five areas are priorities. In another case, and again, I'm just going on, sure, there's many, many ways to do it, they may simply try and influence the budget process by saying, we would like to see money flow to defense or from defense to the, they may do it by sector. Mm-hmm. They won't really get into specifics. They'll just say, we're going to emphasize the health sector and put more money into it, or we need to put more money in defense or whatever. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, the reality is while they're governing, priorities come up all the time. And it's not really analyzed very often, but this whole crisis management aspect of center of government, which again is quite often overlooked, but that's how priorities get set on. I think that's true in any country. I mean, Hurricane Katrina became a priority. Wasn't in the campaign platform, obviously.
Absolutely. And it seems on the priorities, one approach that we often see is this sort of setting very broad sector, as you mentioned, more than to improve health, and coming up with three or four really broad, and then articulating specific promises as time goes on. But it's both selling it to your potentially to your coalition partners, but just as, if not more importantly, selling it to the public as well. And so, so the more simplistic terms you're able to use, at least for the public's perception, it's helpful. And then you can sort of have your sort of behind the scenes.
Yeah, and you see those where they have these, that's sort of like a technocrat's strategic planning system, where you'll have each you know, you'll divide things into 16 sectors and you'll have four cross-cutting sectors or whatever. And each one of them will have two or three strategic goals, and then it breaks down into objectives, and then there's all sorts of activities and budget stuff that goes on to make it happen. But in a sense, that system, although it looks very organized, is not really a priority system. That's just a way to organize everything that's done in government. The priorities that actually become meaningful is where the Prime Minister would, or the President would say, I want to, you know, do this. Well, you know, something very concrete. I'm going to build either a highway from here to here, or I'm going to train, you know, our emphasis is education, and we're going to train 10,000 teachers and, you know, establish a new university, or something, you know, more concrete sort of things. Because, you know, when you set those broad priorities, ministries are very adept at adapting everything they would do normally and just pretending it falls under these sort of broad, you know, like modernize the civil service or something, you know. So,
in your experience, what strategies work best for enhancing the quality of policy papers, particularly when the capacity at the ministerial level is quite low? Another challenge that we see in a lot of places.
Yeah, I mean, this is always a tricky thing. First of all, in so many developing countries, they don't have a history of policy development. And there's two types of systems that I can think of in which this happens. And the one is just simply where the government is just, you know, in a sense, very new and hasn't really developed its own machinery of government yet. So it's something that, you know, is sort of evolving. It just isn't there. The other are a lot of systems, particularly sort of in Eastern Europe and some in Asia, are just incredibly legally based, and so they tend to put everything is done through laws. So you would have in some of these European countries, you used to have 400 or 500 laws each year coming from the government to going through Parliament. So if everything's a law, then policy becomes something meaningless. They don't even understand what it would be. So you have to separate those two types of systems. In the ones where it's just sort of policies evolving, I mean, what you have to do is you know just those very basic reforms, like they're described in your cabinet thing, is from your cabinet office, headed with the cabinet secretary saying this must be done. Mm-hmm. You develop some kind of policy manual. And one thing I've seen done in some countries, you test it on the ministers themselves. They're your customers. In designing it, you're not doing it to, please ministries or please yourselves. You're trying to produce a document that can be used by a cabinet to make decisions. Mm-hmm. So it's a really good idea to test, to find out what types of documents will appeal to the ministers and the prime minister.
How do you do that test? Or what does that test look like?
You usually would, depending on, there's different ways to do it, but you might sort of pick a couple of ministries with that you know are pretty good, have some good policy people in, and you develop a couple of policy papers with them. You work collegially. And, then you flow it up, and either you could take the cabinet or just give it to the prime minister and say, does this give you the type of information you want? And you let them critique it, and then you get a feel for it. And then when they're sort of happy with it, then you might write a cabinet manual that would then tell ministries how policy papers will come forward in future. And You should be, at that point, you should be thinking about strongly engaging the ministries in some kind of internal training program to get them up to snuff. And again, depending on the capacity in ministries, you'll have to adapt it accordingly. I mean, some governments create policy units or policy and monitoring units in each ministry. Others sort of just maybe make it more, phase it in, like you start with the important ministries, have them do policy papers. But the whole point is just to, routinize the flow of these decision-making documents, because that's all they are, from the ministries to the government. Mm-hmm. Again, when there's a lot of donors running around in countries, which of course is often the case, you would appeal to the donor community to ask them, instead of sending 75-page you know, glossy strategies to cabinet for them to approve, where the ministers don't even have a clue what they're approving, that they work with the ministries to produce, you know, policy documents along the same lines as the government requirements, and that those go up, and, you know, with all that money behind it, often they could be quite good, and then they serve as examples too. And then so you share it around, and it's just a culture that develops over time, and you know, hopefully it survives the transition of government, and then everyone, all the ministers, are just used to it.
It seems what's really important, or one of the aspects that's really important in this policy paper process, is that the ministers are able to sort of digest and understand and grasp the issues before they come to the actual cabinet meeting, which itself could be sort of almost a pro forma discussion / vote on the issue, but there needs to be a preparatory phase.
Yeah, well, there's a similar
prior to that, yeah. and it differs by country, but yeah. But enhancing the quality of these papers.
Yeah. Well, it's not just the papers. The other thing is the actual architecture of the decision making stuff. You can't. We'll start with that one. You can't just have a cabinet. You know, things can't just, well, you can, but think, you know, in principle, things just shouldn't flow from ministry to cabinet, ministry to cabinet. I mean, what most governments do, because then they'll be meeting for, you know, 12 hours, is most governments do is set up some kind of subcommittees where, say, for instance, you know, there'll be a social policy committee, an economic policy committee, and maybe security and governance, something along those lines, where the ministers themselves, because you know, most policies of one ministry will affect other ministries, so you put together the ministries that are most likely to you know, affect each other, and those papers initially go to those committees, and they digest them, and the cabinet office people help with this. They're very important in it. And so basically it gets sort of, use the term, pre-cooked there,
yeah.
And there has to be agreement. And then by the time it goes to cabinet, all the ministers are agreed on it. And because cabinet office has been involved, they'll alert the prime minister if they see any problems. Maybe cabinet office will have set up some kind of you know, dispute resolution mechanism. You know, but the whole point is to try and get an agreement before it gets to the cabinet table and has to take up the prime minister's time. Things that the prime minister really cares about, the prime minister may sit on his own or her own cabinet committee for priorities or something like that, and those things might flow through that, because that's one where the prime minister, in a sense, wants time. Because these committees are set up in a way that it's a forum where you can debate policy, you can read through the options and discuss it at more length, and cabinet is much more perfunctory, if it's going to work well, if we approve this or don't, you know, or we're sending it back, that kind of
thing. Right, exactly. On the topic of ministerial performance contracts, a number of countries have gone ahead and adopted them. Could you say a few words about how these contracts work and how well they work in your experience?
It varies. You know, in Canada years ago, there was something called, you know, one of the prime ministers just personally wrote a one-page letter. It was called Letter to the Minister. And that was, in that case, it was his expectations of each minister. And they would meet, you know, once a year to discuss it. These were not public because, you know, it was considered confidential. And, you know, that was, that was the mechanism. But, you know, in most systems, you can see whether the minister's performing or not because the prime minister will replace them. It's fairly, you know, pretty clear. Or shuffle them to a less important post, promote them to a more important post, that kind of thing. So, you know, it's not a public process. In some countries, though, and especially in some developing countries, they've certainly gotten, not quite carried away, but enthused about having ministerial contracts, and often these are public. I remember in one country I was working in Eastern Europe, the prime minister would hold a press conference once a year, and go through each of his ministers and say, this one did well on, you know, and this, it was mostly, this one did well, this one didn't do well, you know. And so it kind of worked in the sense of, since the prime minister was sitting there and was getting all sorts of coverage, the ministries who didn't do well had obvious incentives to do better in the following year.
So what about that, the context of this particular country led the prime minister to decide, you know what, I have to make this a more of a public spectacle versus quiet one-on-one conversations with my ministers. I'm wondering what the rationale, what the strategic decision making is.
It probably came from more of a, you know, I'd say sort of more of a cultural switch. It was a former communist country, and again, going from a totally closed, political system, they in a sense went much further than the developed countries in being open. If you look, you know, like those countries now, like you look at, you know, I know in Latvia, for instance, they post policy papers online before they're even reviewed by the government. We would never do that in a developed country. So they are, in a sense, have become hyper-open countries, on these types of issues, at least. And so it was part of that new sense of openness, and the Prime Minister thought, well, this would be great. And he was happy to. And again, it was coalition government. So, you know, sometimes politics comes into this. I didn't check to see if all the poor performing ministers were from other parties or not. But, that was part of it. It was just part of this so-called, you know, commitment to openness. And they're trying to get into the European Union. So they thought that this would play well with their... with your European EU colleagues and that kind of thing.
Are there places where these performance contracts simply don't work?
Yeah, well, you know, it's not that the... for sure. But it's generally not that the performance contracts don't work. It's that the system itself is not performing. And there's all sorts, and then you get into infinite reasons for that happening. But, for one thing, if some of the most common ones... are that the commitments themselves have not been... Okay, if I had to pick one, is the commitments themselves have not been properly linked to the budget. So the funds just simply aren't there to deliver the promise. Like, they do policy papers, but, they don't really... they're not fully aware of how much it's going to cost to implement them. A second reason is just simply... the most common reason is underestimating how much time it takes to do things. I mean, everyone loves to, especially like the World Bank will set their three-year matrix, and they'll say by year three, all these reforms will be in place, and that's just because, they have to get their loan term is in 3 years. In reality, it's going to take 10 years to do it. And people forget that, you have to draft a law, and then it has to go through Parliament, and then you have to do regulations, and then you have to set up delivery units in the ministries, and blah, 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 so it can take 5-10 years to deliver something. So those are two of the reasons that so often it doesn't work. When it does work, it's because the countries have understood that the sort of choreography between money and policy.
Alternation of parties in power means that one head of government or head of state must hand off know-how to another. And curious, what are the most common problems that you've seen that would impede a successful transition? And whether there are some remedies that can help?
Yeah, sure. Well, the biggest problem is, especially in developing countries, is highly politicized systems. And by that I mean, it's like in the United States, I think it's probably one of the in the developed world, the main example is, 10,000 civil servants will suddenly be out of a job when, a new government comes in. Now, that's all fine because you have all these think tanks that 10,000 can flow back and, all's well. But they don't have that in developing countries. So if you basically fire all your top management down to your director level, for instance, it's going to take the hiring process. You're going to have people who aren't even fit for the jobs. They have no experience. It's going to take them 2 years to figure out their new jobs, even if they're bright people. So that's one big issue. The second big issue is there's not a mechanism to really transmit information forward. And for instance, in a developed country like in Canada, the cabinet office, 3 months before an election, we'll start organizing briefing manuals for a new government, budget briefings, little very simplistic things like ministers' guides, on how to find their office, procedures manuals, so that on their first cabinet meeting they understand how it will work. And even if the same government wins, then it's not as important. But there's all sorts of new ministers in this, so there's a whole machinery that goes into planning a transition. So you don't have this experience in many you know, developing countries. So, you know, you just suddenly have all these, this new government turns up with their offices and they don't know what's happening. There's no one there to brief them.
Right.
It's sort of chaos for a while. It takes a while to sort out. In Ghana, for instance, they did, in Africa, there's been a lot of transitions of government in Africa, but they have started introducing these sorts of measures. Mm-hmm. And so the transition from one government to another has been much smoother than, you know, certainly in other, African countries.
Who's been responsible in the Ghana example for introducing those?
Well,
it was
through a Canadian project that it was done, but the people that were responsible were people in the president's office and the cabinet office. I mean, that's almost always who coordinates this, and they just simply thought it would be a good practice to do, and so they did it. And I believe the government that came in afterwards probably has done the same thing, because there's been an election since then.
Interesting. As we work our way to a conclusion, I wonder in the time that you've worked in this field, what are the main ways the collective wisdom or thinking about this subject has changed? And the subject being sort of center of government reforms.
Yeah. Well, separated between center of government reform and center of government. I mean, center of government is an institution is remarkably stable from decade to decade. There's, you know, it's still, you know, 40 years ago, a bunch of people, anywhere between 12 and 30, depending on the country, gather in a room, they meet every week, you know, papers flow up to them, they make decisions, there's they have a few political advisors, a small to medium-sized administrative office to support them, and none of that has changed all that much over 40 years. When I look at sort of, by comparison, what's happened in the public finance field with all the changes in, you know, accounting approaches and all this kind of thing, it hasn't undergone the same degree of change as other areas of government. So what has changed in center of government in recent years? I mean, there's been obviously a lot of computerization is helping. It's not really changing things so much as it is just simply helping that you now have e-cabinets where the ministers come in and a laptop pops up and papers are there. So it's more efficiency measures than actually changing the way in which the center of government works. In terms of the reforms themselves, in developing countries, it's a relatively new field in the sense that the first ones that, you know, I was aware of that were sort of big projects were sort of in the mid to late 90s. So it hasn't been going on so long that this field has changed much. And also as a field, it doesn't have that niche that, say, civil service reform or public finance reform has. It's out there. It's been, there's certainly been center government reforms in probably anywhere between 25 and 50 countries that I know of in terms of developing countries. But it's not like a natural field the way the other ones are. So it happens, but it's sort of underrepresented. In fact, you know, your Princeton case studies are probably that and the Sigma collection, which was in the sort of late 90s, early 2000s, are the only two bodies of literature that have documented center government reforms.
Interesting. And then finally, in conclusion, just to go back to the discussion of cabinet reforms, one challenge for a head of state and the reform team that goes about implementing these reforms is the question of how do we sustain this once we're gone, once my administration is no longer in power. And are there ways to think about the question of how do you ensure that when you undertake the reform, you put in place certain elements that are sustainable, whether that's simply designing certain systems that are likely to carry on, whether that's changing the expectations, perhaps at the ministry level, so that people sort of demand that these reforms continue. Could you talk to that?
I mean, that's basically it. You institutionalize it. Well, to some degree, some prime ministers and presidents may not care that these things are sustained once they're out of power because they would like to remain in power. But that aside, many of them do take the bigger picture. And, you know, again, there's the whole, you know, the question of how do you institutionalize things? Well, in some countries, the ones that are very legalistic, you'll want to pass a law because, you know, laws are everything. In other countries that are less legalistic, you might just get by with a cabinet manual. But the whole point of it is that there are you have a core group of people in cabinet office and in ministries that is just the way you do things. And, you know, you become routinized with it, and that becomes the process. It's not a reform. It's just simply the way things are done. So new government comes in. They're going to go, how do you do things? You go, well, this is the way we do things. So unless they have a different idea, they're not going to throw it out. I mean, you know, we're not talking about partisan positions in policy issues. We're talking about the way information is structured to flow to a decision maker. And in each government, they'll change the committee structure, or they'll do this or that. There's always changes they'll make, or they'll set up some special office in the center for some priority, like set up a delivery unit or something. But the overall process, if you've managed to, you know, routinize it, you know, during your reform period, will more or less just carry on. Now, having said that, every single government, and this includes developed and developing country governments, gets lazy. you know, it becomes over-bureaucratized, it becomes disconnected from decision-making, finance goes off in its own, Ministry of Finance goes off in its own direction, and it kind of starts falling apart. And then, you know, whenever that happens, it's going to be someone's job, some new prime minister, president will come in and be fed up with it and say, I want to fix it. So you do it again. But, you know, it's just a cycle. It's not really just sort of a linear process that gets formalized forever. But you've got to get past that. You have to have that critical mass of people in permanent civil service positions that just see it as the system and will present that to anyone coming in.
Thanks so much for your time. This has been really insightful. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.